This is the beginning of Class 7.
Sanshi Bhagi Jushin Neto Jham Vira Vinshi Nyende Kempadi Sanye Shindu Mite Uwagi Jogu Nanda Shimba
generally known for his Tantric commentary, and the other great student is Kapha Sutra.
Gyalpa Jain.
And he's known for his logic commentary, but both of them wrote about logic and both of them wrote about Tantric. So we're going to study Kedub Jay's presentation. And Kedub Jay's presentation about past and future lives hinges on what we call Nyanengigyu. Say Nyanengigyu.
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 As opposed to Gen. Say Gen.
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 Alright. Gyu means carve. Gyu means carve. And Gen means condition. Or secondary factor. And in Buddhism, it's very important. A lot of books, like Abhidharma, talks about it, and other books. What do you think is the? Well, let me finish. Nyerlen means I call it material cause. Nyerlen means material.
Would you like primary?
Well, I'll give you an example. Nyerlen means I call it material cause. Nyerlen means material.
Would you like primary?
Well, I'll give you an example and you tell me, okay? It's a very difficult word. Nyerlen means, I call it material cause. Okay? Nyerlen means material.
Would you like primary?
Well, I'll give you an example and you tell me, okay? It's a very difficult word. But it's not a difficult idea. When you plant a tree, when you plant, what are those trees? Are we oak trees? when you plant an acorn. An acorn, yeah. Okay, so the acorn is the Nirnegi Gyupan oak tree. Why? Because it's the stuff that turns into the tree. It's the thing, in Tibetan they say flop over. It's the thing that goes da-da-da-da-da and then flops into a tree. It's called Namasachua and Chilosachua. It literally means, you know, it goes through its life cycle, the acorn, and then at one point it transforms into the tree. It's the stuff that turns into the tree, and by turning into the tree itself, disappears. So you imagine that moment when the acorn is sprouting and it's become a small tree. So the acorn is the material that turns into the tree. That's why I call it material cause. There's a lot of other meanings of material cause in Western philosophy. I don't know what they are. But when I say material cause, I mean the stuff that turns into the result. Well, like in the case of a pot, a clay pot, what's the stuff that turns into the pot? What's the Nirnegi Gyupa? The clay. In the case of a ceramic pot, the Nirnegi Gyupa is the clay. And like that, what are the gems, what are the other conditions that are around when an oak tree grows? Yeah, sun, water, fertilizer, earth. They don't directly turn into the tree. I mean, you can find some of the nutrients that were in the soil are in the tree, but they are not the main thing that flops over into the tree. There's always some similarity between the Nirlinki Gyu and its result. There's always some thing in common, some characteristics in common between the Nirlinki Gyu and its result. That's why you don't plant tomato seeds to get oak trees. There's something about an acorn that is some kind of similar stuff to the oak tree. And another quality of a Nirlinga Gyu. There's some similarity. There is some kind of corresponding stuff between an acorn and an oak tree. And that's the rule of all Nirlinga Gyus. There's always some similarity. And we accept that when we go out into a field. If we didn't believe in Nirlinga Gyus, we would go out in the field and water and throw fertilizer and wait without planting a seed. And if we had a wrong idea about Nirlinga Gyus, we would go out and plant tomato seeds and wait for oranges to come up. And you wait for a long time. It doesn't work that way. There must be some similarity between the Nirlinga Gyu and its result. That's the nature of a Nirlinga Gyu.
You need both those modes.
You must have both. Okay. The thing won't grow without both. And are in the tree. But they are not the main thing that flops over into the tree. There's always some similarity between the Nirlinga Gyu and its result. There's always some thing in common, some characteristics in common between the Nirlinga Gyu and its result. That's why you don't plant tomato seeds to get oak trees. There's something about an acorn that is some kind of similar stuff to the oak tree. And another quality of a Nirlinga Gyu. There's some similarity. There is some kind of corresponding stuff between an acorn and an oak tree. And that's the rule of all Nirlinga Gyus. There's always some similarity. And we accept that when we go out into a field. If we didn't believe in Nirlinga Gyus, we would go out in the field and water and throw fertilizer and wait without planting a seed. And if we had a wrong idea about Nirlinga Gyus, we would go out and plant tomato seeds and wait for oranges to come up. And you wait for a long time. It doesn't work that way. There must be some similarity between the Nirlinga Gyu and its result. That's the nature of a Nirlinga Gyu.
You need both those.
You must have both. Okay. The thing won't grow without both. But the main one which is important is the Nyanam Gyu. We say you don't not do with Dobrikyam. It's that unique cause which, if it's missing or if you destroyed it, the result what? Could never come up. You forget it. I mean, without enough sunlight, you know, maybe the tree grow, but it'll be wimpy. You know, without sufficient water, it might be skinny. Without nutrients in the earth, it would be like the corn in my monastery. But without the acorn, forget it. If you damage the acorn or you remove the acorn, it cannot be an oak tree. That's a Nyanam Gyu. Can I sometimes translate as factor or condition or secondary factor? And all those other things are kins. The water, the sunlight, the nutrients in the earth, those are all kins. Everyone translates them differently, but you know what they are now. Okay. I would say I like cause and factor because you say, you know, it was a factor, but it wasn't the main cause. It was a factor in the accident, but it wasn't the real cause. Now we want to find out the Nyanam Gyu for a very specific object. And that is the mind at the first moment of conception. Or wherever, whenever you believe the first moment of mind occurs. According to Buddhism, it's the moment that the egg and the sperm meet. There is a mind begins. Consciousness begins. And we want to find the Nyanam Gyu for that. Our goal tonight is to establish the Nyanam Gyu for that first moment of consciousness. Okay? You can't remember it. You know you had it. Okay. I don't care whether you think it happened at that first moment of conception or whether you think it happened later on, you know, after a month or after 2 months, but you have to agree, and you can agree, that there was a first moment of your mind in this life. That there was a first moment of consciousness in this life. What was the content of that first moment of consciousness? Definitely very primitive. You know, you were aware of heat. It was an awareness of heat, or an awareness of wetness, or awareness of motion of the mother, or something like that. But you can assume, although you can't remember it, that you did have a first moment of consciousness in this life. And I don't think there's any Western scientist that would disagree. We accept that the mind is a stream and that it had a beginning moment. And there must have been. So you focus your mind on that moment tonight. You know, get that clear in your mind. There was a first moment in this life of consciousness, of awareness. Some kind of very basic, primitive thought. Not even a thought, an awareness. Probably it was a sense awareness of warmth or wetness. Probably it was tactile, I would guess. You know, it wasn't like a smell or a hearing or something like that. Some kind of very primitive first consciousness in the spaghetti noodle of your mind that has come up to now. Do Western people accept the idea of a stream of consciousness? Of course. You send your children to the first grade because you believe that by the fourth grade they collect knowledge. The knowledge is collected somewhere. And there has to be a connection between the mind in the first grade and the mind in the fourth grade, or you wouldn't send your children to school. You wouldn't have grades. You wouldn't have second, third, fourth grade because there'd be no reason if there wasn't a mind stream. So we accept the mind stream. You don't go to school and say to your teacher, I don't like the stuff you're putting in my kid's mind stream right now. You know, but actually that's what you mean when you go and complain about what they're teaching your kid. It's the idea of a mind stream. You're accepting a mind stream. So we're talking about the first moment of that mind stream in this life. What was the Nyanam Gyu for that? Not talking Gens. Not interested in Gens. Okay? Not talking about the water and the earth and the sunlight, the other factors, the secondary conditions that were going on. We want to know the stuff that flip-flopped into mind, into the first moment of consciousness. Excuse me? No Westerner can answer that. No Westerner can say that. I mean, according to our Western...
Westerners believe in reincarnation.
Not quite. Oh, but people who do, and even Tibetan Buddhists, and I'd say 99% of Tibetan Buddhists, have no idea why it's correct. It happens to be correct, but they have no logical reason for it. It's just their mommy told them that, and they believe it. I was in Russia, and somebody said, religion is like language. You just do whatever your parents did. You know, she says, there was a lady, and she was very eloquent. She said, you know, I speak Russian because my parents spoke Russian. And if my parents had spoken English, I'd be speaking English. And our religion is the same. Whatever they did, you do. You know, and that, there's no better reason than that. And even Tibetan Buddhists, who happen to believing in the right thing, have no idea why. In most cases.
Seems like.
So Kedar J does a thing, it's called a proof by elimination. Okay. He's going to go through all the possible things that first moment of consciousness could have come from, and he's going to eliminate them one by one. So to do that, you have to have this big outline of all the things that exist. And he does. And it's not so big. You've had this before in another class, I think. But we'll go through it again. Say, Shija.
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 What does she mean? What's the she in Yeshe called? Shira.
Consciousness.
To know. Okay. And Ja means something you can know. Knowable thing. Sheja means knowable thing. The newspaper, the magazine that His Holiness's office puts out every month in Dharamsala is called Sheja. It means stuff to know. News. Knowable object. Sheja. It's a synonym for all existing things. Anything that can be known. Why do you think it's a synonym for all existing things? Is it true that all things that exist are known by someone? The Buddha. Okay. According to us. Therefore, existence and thing which is known are equal. Because there is a being in the universe who knows everything. Sheja. Two kinds of Sheja. Say Tapa.
Nitapa.
Tapa means unchanging. Nitapa means changing. Tapa means unchanging. And Nitapa means changing. Don't get confused by the negative in the Tibetan, the mean. Don't get confused by it. It's a long story, and if you had all night, I could tell you.
Isn't
Tapa
impermanent?
Excuse me?
Isn't Tapa impermanent?
Yeah, I don't like that word. I mean, I don't like that translation. I think it's wrong. And you want to know why? just briefly, why I don't use that word. This wall is tapa or mitapa?
Mitapa.
Excuse me?
Mitapa.
It's mitapa. It's a changing thing. It's impermanent, if you will. Okay. What about the emptiness of the wall? What is the emptiness of the wall according to the highest school? The fact that it's not anything else than my naming an image in my mind. That negative thing. And you don't write that down, that's not the point of tonight's class. But when you, and that's tapa or mitapa, the emptiness of the wall. Tapa. Unchanging. The emptiness of the wall is unchanging. The emptiness of the wall is unchanging. Coming.
Oh.
Okay? It never changes in its quality. Its nature never changes the least tiny bit. This wall is enough. As long as this wall is ever here, it will always be nothing more than my naming and mental image. Therefore, its emptiness is stuck. Okay. Now, when I destroy the wall, is there still an emptiness in the world?
No.
No. The basis of the emptiness is gone. Therefore, that emptiness is no longer there. That emptiness is still thought. That's why I don't use like the word permanent. The emptiness of the wall is not permanent, in my opinion. Because when the wall is destroyed, the emptiness goes away. But it is unchanging. It never changes in its quality. As long as it exists, it's constant. It's always the same thing. It's never more or less empty. So that's why I don't use that word. In a long room, when you're talking about death and they use the word mitapa, impermanence is fine. That's correct. Anyway, and by the way, you'll understand that one day in deep meditation, you'll have a direct perception of this distinction. And that's not a perception of emptiness, but it's a very deep thing that can only happen to you in meditation. And you'll see the subtle meaning of impermanence.
What's that?
Changing you. Anyway, now we ask, could that... By the way, is the mind... Are we assuming the mind has to have a cause? Is that correct? I mean, is that much correct? Is it true that the first moment of consciousness has to have a cause?
Yeah, but you...
Could
I
it
asked,
be causeless?
I asked once what the difference... What things were uncaused, and you said you weren't talking about it right now.
Oh, I can tell you space.
Can you?
Empty space.
But how do you...
And emptiness. And it's a long... Its quality
well,
never...
Emptiness, I understand.
No, space is easy.
Space.
Its quality never changes. Space is not the void outside, and space is not the place between these two walls. It's a wrong explanation, and you'll hear people say that in Dharma teaching. It's incorrect. And it's taught in the first chapter of the Abhidhamma Kosha. Space is a place where this pen is. And when I take the pen out of the space, does anything happen to the space? Does it ever change? When I fill the space, does it ever change? It never changes its quality. It doesn't become more or less spacey. It never changes its quality. That's why space is one of the few things in the universe which is unchanging and uncaused. Long story. We'll do it someday when
space
we do it.
Space seems inadequate.
I think you ought to say empty space. You know, it's a long story. There are in the Abhidhamma Kosha some non-Buddhists and even some Buddhists come and try to present wrong ideas of space. For example, that it's the black stuff out there that the planets are resting in. And that's wrong. And then you see more sophisticated people say it's the place between the two walls, and that's wrong. It's a little bit tricky.
Sorry.
Anyway, not tonight's subject. Tapa means tapa. So first of all, can we agree that the mind at the moment of conception or whenever you believe it's starting, does it have to have a cause?
Yeah. Well,
it has to have a
cause.
Huh? Well, I think the main reason you can say is that it's what were the arguments we already had? Why did omniscience have to have a cause? Why did omniscience have to be changing? Remember? Because it was focusing on a changing object.
Right.
And therefore it was always changing in its quality. And also because it has... Anything which is variable has to have a cause.
What?
I'll say it again. Anything that's variable has to have a cause. Because something is making it... As the cause loses its power, the thing changes. So anything, therefore anything changing has to have a cause. I'll say it again. Anything that changes has to have a cause. There's energy behind it, and that energy is fluctuating. And as long as the thing that's throwing it into existence is fluctuating, that thing is changing. And the thing is getting less or more, or here or there, or farther or closer, or bigger or smaller. It's fluctuating.
It's like
more
and up.
The mind stream has no beginning or end.
We didn't prove that yet. No, but each moment of mind has to have a cause. Because the mind is changing. For example, I just changed your mind. All right? This object stimulates certain kinds of visual consciousnesses in you. And as I remove the object or present the object, your visual consciousness fluctuates. It changes. And mind is, that's the nature of mind, and it's obvious. It's not unchanging. If it were unchanging, there'd be no Buddhahood, because you could never get rid of your nyamas, your bad thoughts. You might as well give up. It is changing. It fluctuates. And you experience that even as I speak, it's fluctuating by the instant. Anything that fluctuates has a cause. Assuming that you agree, by the way, everything I say tonight you won't agree to. And I don't expect you to accept everything I say tonight. But it starts the process of your doubting the bias that you were given when you were a child, which happens to be wrong, and which is a great obstacle to your achieving Buddhahood. So, as this course goes on, if it ever does, you will, at least it'll put a few cracks in your belief, or you'll start thinking of where did that first moment of mind come from. And as you get more exposed to these arguments, which you won't accept the first night or the second night, you'll start to doubt the position that you have now, which is only because of your birth. It's that Russian language thing. You know, it's only because of where you grew up that you believe that. And as you start to doubt it, your behavior should change. Because if we're talking billions of years of future, or rather than 20 years left at best, things change. You know, like, I'd like to clean out my mind. If I'm going to be stuck with this mind for millions of years, then let me clean it up, you know. Then it becomes a different priority, and you'll start to experience that. It will become, hopefully this class, I mean, hopefully these arguments will start to have that effect on you. Okay, if I'm going to be around indefinitely, rather than just for the next 20 years, and then get some kind of, what do you call it? There's a Greek word for mindlessness. Lethe or something. I don't know. You know, if you could reach a place after death, subconsciously everyone in this room believes that they're going to die, and at that moment the mind just kind of goes away, and you won't have to be around anymore, and whatever bad time you're having now will end. But if it were the other way, and if whatever anxieties you have in your mind now, and whatever indecisions, and whatever torments by desire or doubt or anger you have in your mind now are going to go on indefinitely if you don't do something about them now, that changes things. You know? Then it's in your interest to clean up your mind now. Because if I got to have this kind of mind forever, that's quite unpleasant. You know? So, is that cause, Vyalingigyu, of the first moment of consciousness, put your mind back on the first moment of this life, of your consciousness, can the cause be tattva? Can that cause be tattva? Can that cause be something unchanging? No. We had it when we discussed the Creator. When the Creator creates, He has to change. The Creator, 5 minutes after He created the universe, and the Creator, 5 minutes before He created the universe, are different guys. He has to expend some energy. He has to be different. Cause cannot be unchanging. By delivering the baby, the mother changes. By delivering the result, the oak tree sprouts, the acorn changes. It must change. So the thing we're looking for, which is what? What are we looking for tonight? Nyanagigyu. The thing that flopped over into the first moment of consciousness in this life cannot be tattva. We can eliminate that one.
Michael, is there actually a point at which the cause ceases and...
Big debate. Big debate in the monastery.
I mean,
huge fight. When you really put your mind on it, and you try to imagine the moment that the cause stopped being the cause and became the result, that's actually one practice for recognizing emptiness. You can't. It's inconceivable. Something, that concept if you really put your mind on it, can lead you to a perception of emptiness. Because it's impossible. It's an impossibility. We live on it. We believe in it. You know, but if you try to imagine it, if you try to conceive of it, you can't. And it can lead you to a perception of emptiness. It is one method of perceiving emptiness. Long story. Okay.
You're saying it's an artificial
It does. Yeah, it does. It really does.
Karmically, it certainly does.
Basically, and I say basically, when I say basically, it means there's an exception. Like a logician has to say that. But basically, mitapa, there are two kinds of mitapa. Say, bembo.
Bembo.
Shepa.
Shepa.
Bembo.
Bembo.
Shepa.
Shepa.
I want to change this one. I mean, it's not the one. This is a synonym, but I want to put it differently. Say Bembo.
Bembo.
Rigpa.
Rigpa.
Same thing. Shepa and Rigpa are similar. But I prefer this one because he used it. Bembo means matter. Physical matter. Its definition in Tibetan is Dilda Drupa. That which is composed of atoms. It's composite matter. Physical matter. You know, Rigpa means, do you know Rigpa? I think some Dharma. Some Dharma group uses it as a name. Yeah, Rigpa literally means just mind, as opposed to Bembo, which is what? Matter. Mind and matter. Okay, we have the word in English, mind and matter. Bembo is matter, Rigpa is mind. Basically, and there are a few exceptions, all changing things are either mind or matter.
So when you refer to energy, would that be an exception?
Is it there's more certain subtle kind of John Stillwell yeah. is an exception. He's a changing thing which is neither mind nor matter.
Combination?
He's a concept, actually. But so I'm not going to get into it. But basically, mind or matter. Basically, mind or matter. We're going to look at matter first. Because right? We know the punchline is over there, right? So. Yeah, we'll probably go off the board. I usually do right. We're going to look at Bembo. Two kinds of Bembo. Say Rongbo.
Rongbo.
Chisu.
Chisu.
Rongbo.
Rongbo.
Chisu.
Chisu.
Okay. Rong you know, right? Rong means what?
Empowerment.
Empowerment, right? Rongbo means a sense power. The five sense powers. The root is the same. The root that's used as a tantric empowerment, long, is the same as long form. Generally, both of those words mean strength, or energy, or power. So, Wangbo refers to the five sense powers. And Qi, well, we'll get into Qi some later. Wangbo. So, what are your five Wangbos? They're stated in the Heart Sutra. Mikme, Nawame, Name, Chenme, Me. The eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the skin, the body. Responsible for sensing visual objects, audible objects, gustatory objects, olfactory, gustatory, and tangible. Okay. Anyway, things you see, things you hear, things you smell, things you taste, and things you feel. In the Abhidharma and in Buddhist philosophy in general, it's believed, for example, that at the back of your eyeball there's a small patch of cells that can sense visual objects. And as an object changes in front of that group of cells, it senses a difference. And it conveys that difference to eye consciousness. It is not eye consciousness. It's a patch of cells that has a sense function. It has a sensitivity to changes in color and shape. And that's called the power of the eye, the sense power of the eye. So it's not your consciousness of the eye. It's a physical group of stuff in the eyeball, the back of the eye. We call it the optic nerve. That senses changes in color and shapes and sense transmits that data to the and actually help stimulate a consciousness of the eye, consciousness of colors and shapes. It's not mind. It's physical stuff. It's living matter. So you can say Wangbo here refers to living matter. It's not mind. It's physical stuff. It's sensitive, but it's not knowing.
Why couldn't you say that the mind is simply that accumulation or compilation of all that sensing stuff which is processing? And
It's a long story. In the Abhidharma, the mind comes a moment later. You're always a moment in the past. You know, the object has been presented to the optic nerve, and the mind is only aware of it the next moment, after it is stimulated by the conjunction of an object, the sense power, and then that stimulates a mental awareness. So it's a different thing to sense colors and to be aware of colors. The optic nerve has some kind of sensation, and it sends it to the... It stimulates a consciousness. But it's not the consciousness. It's a physical stuff. Why? If you scrape off, you know, the back of the eyeball, and you can't see anymore, there's no more sensing of colors and shit. Okay? So, that's one option. For what? What are we looking for?
Oh, we're looking for the mind.
We're looking for the thing that flopped over into the first moment of your consciousness in this life. Where did it come from? I mean, you don't spend your nights worrying about it, right? But this is the key to finding past and future lives. We don't accept in normal Buddhism the method of saying, oh, some people remember their past lives. Don't accept it. Why? It cannot be communicated to me in a logical way. I cannot perceive past lives based on this person saying, oh, I remember my past life. I can't have a tema about it. Based on someone coming up to me and saying, I remember my past life, doesn't help me. I cannot have a valid perception of my past life based on someone else claiming that he remembers his past life. Cannot. So we're not interested in that kind of proof. It's not a proof, what I'm saying. We need something like this. This is not just an exercise. It's airtight. If you follow with me and if you accept each step, and by the end of this evening, you must accept that you had a past life. And you can go home and worry about the details, or say that I don't accept one of these things up here. But if you're really a reasonable person, a reasoning being, you don't have any choice but to accept that there was some kind of nearly good view of mind before that. And you won't believe it and you won't change tonight. But it'll affect you. And that's, yeah, slowly it should affect you. Yeah.
It's not clear to me why the sense powers
aren't mind itself
valid. Well, maybe I'm taking this a step farther. The way you're describing sense powers as a conglomeration of
active living
cells interacting with its surroundings.
Yeah.
As you describe that as a sense power, why can't that same definition apply to mind as a conglomeration of living cells interacting, you know, amongst themselves and with the external environment?
That's a tough question for me. I don't know, but I'd say that basically. The basic difference between mind and matter. You're asking what's the difference between mind and matter in Buddhism? Matter consists of atoms. Matter is not aware. It doesn't have awareness. Does it have life? Yes. It can be living. And the sense powers are living. And physical things, it's interesting. The definition of, for example, visual objects are anything I can point to as a visual object. It's that basic. So I'd say the differences are many and it would take a long time, but basically matter is composed of atoms. Matter is not aware. Matter is not crystal clear, which awareness is.
In a way, are you saying that in a way awareness is produced as a result of the interaction of all the organic matter?
The confluent, or the joining together of an object and the sense power. And it's actually in the wheel of life, one of the links, which is Shiva Mitsu, Dukarekpa, number six. That's the confluence of those two things.
In the psychology, they made a distinction between sensation and perception. I mean, the science is invested up too, but the sensation is a physical thing that can be measured very easily, like how much light gets into people or something like that. There's a part of the brain that does interpretation with all the senses. Then you give it the same. I don't know if that answers
the question. Okay. We'll get into the definition of mind. You'll study mind. You'll study Buddhist psychology. So Wango is living matter, and chi means outer, outside, and suk means form. Chi suk means outside physical stuff. Okay, not included into a living being. So it'd be like the wall, the carpet, the smell of my dogs. Those are cheese soup, okay? I wish they were more cheese soup. Chi means outer, and soup means form. These are the two kinds of physical matter, and we're going to try to eliminate. Because we want to prove that the cause of that first moment of mind is over on the other side of that tree.
And that it was not included.
Right. Well, there's a big debate, okay? Tip of your hair and the end of your fingernail. Because they demand their own sense. There's no, the powers don't reach that. So are they outer form? Or they're considered to be outer form. Once your fingernail grows so long and you can't feel it if someone goes like that, it's considered outer form. That's a debate.
Point of clarification, you said that awareness is produced by the conscience of an object and sense consciousness.
Yeah, sense power.
Sense power.
Got it. And then the sense consciousness is generated by that.
Okay.
It's inspired by that.
But is there any other form of mind that exists outside of this consciousness?
The mental
consciousness.
Say that again. Mental consciousness
does not depend on a physical sense organ to be stimulated to occur.
So you're saying it exists independently of the brain? And
long story. Didn't say that. But what I mean is, you could have a person who was totally blind, deaf, couldn't smell and taste, and couldn't feel anything, and they would still have a mind. And that's actually what a formless from being is. We're trying to decide whether or not, you know, focus your mind again on what we're trying to figure out. Focus your mind on the first moment of awareness in this life. And then we're trying to figure out what caused it. What flopped over it. And we decided, we're trying to see if it was physical. And right now we're trying to see if it was something living, one of your five sense organs. Five sense powers. And Kirib J's argument is, if you say that it's the five sense powers that flopped over in the way that the acorn flops over into the oak tree, if you say that it's that caused your mind at the first moment of conception, then do all five have to be together, or is any one enough? He's actually giving another choice, but I'm not describing it in English. All five or any one. He says, do all five have to come together, or is any one okay? He says, if you say it has to be all five, then suppose a person's optic nerve is damaged or something. Then you're saying that the mind wouldn't occur. So if if the combination of all five organs is what turns into mind, then if a person lost his eyes, would he lose his mind? Would his mind stop? If you say that all five have to come together for mind to occur, then you're saying that as soon as a person ever loses his eyes, his mind stops? You say no. So he eliminates that one. Then he says, how about any one? And he says, let's take optic nerve, okay? The eye organ, the eye sense part. He says, if that were enough to swap over into mind, this is according to Kate's deal, okay? Then the quality of that sense organ is that it perceives colors and shapes very distinctly. Then it should also be a quality of the mind, independently of the of anything else, independently of the eye, to capture colors and shapes as distinctly as the eye does.
And in the same way.
And it doesn't. In other words, when you try to, you know, you can see your apartment right now. You can see your refrigerator. In your mind's eye, you can imagine your refrigerator at home. But you will never have as clear an image, as clear shapes, and as clear and as vivid colors as you do when you look at your refrigerator. The mental image is always less distinct and less vivid than the physical perception. And Kitabje says, since causes and results have to have a similarity, then if the optic nerve were the cause of your mind, then your mind would have to be able to capture colors and shapes with the same vividness that your eye does. But that's not what happens. And the same applies for hearing and tasting. You can imagine the taste of cotton candy right now, but it doesn't match up to the, you know, the experience of cotton candy by the sense organ. So he says, therefore, no one of them can be either. And that's his argument.
So Michael, in the division, the temporal division there of physical matter, I mean, it seems by saying the sense powers are things outside of our senses, external physical matter, it leaves out the inner organs and other organic matter of the body by just saying the five sense consciousness doesn't...
Five sense organs.
Okay, five sense organs doesn't include the whole totality of our...
Physical body, yes, it does. There's nothing about your physical body that's not related to one of those five sense organs. Every part of your physical body is tactile. I mean, at least.
So you're saying like the brain, the lungs, the inner organs?
You can feel, all of those things can feel.
Yeah. But is the feeling nature of that organ some nature of that organic matter? And so, is it really, if you're only talking about the sensory aspect of the organs and not the whole totality of the organs aspect as organic matter, well, it seems like we're leaving out some of physical matter.
No, because he did say all five. He gave you a choice. All five sense organs together.
But what I'm saying is any of the five, or all of the five sense organs, don't seem to me to be a complete description of, say, the lung.
You have to get used to that idea. It's Abhidharma, the first chapter of Abhidharma. You have to get used to perceiving yourself as a conglomeration of those five senses. Your physical body is. There's nothing outside of that. You're hung up on the visual appearance of the lung. You know, your Western conception of the body is this many long things, this many round things, this many short things. It's not what the body is. The body is the sum of those five organs. And that's just, it takes time. An organ can be the object of another organ. I mean, you can feel the shape of your lung. You know, you could, it could act as an object of the sense of That's true. You could see the veins in your arm.
Those five senses don't seem to describe the complete function, you say, along.
They do. You just gotta get used to it. It takes time. That's Abhidharma. When you study Abhidharma really well, your vision of yourself starts to change. And that's why Abhidharma is useful, even though it's in the air. So that eliminates one goal. Then he goes to Chisu, outside form, outside matter. And I'm not going to go into it too much because I want to finish on time. But okay, there's four elements. We'll talk more about them next week. Did Buddhist scholars, or the Buddha himself, who supposedly could see all objects, did he really believe in this primitive idea that there's little fires going on in you, and the dirt in your arm, and, you know, there's legs in your arm, the four elements, is that primitive idea really acceptable to Buddhism? Yes, very much. And you'll learn more about it next week. They are not, they are, the word, Sachu Memu, the word earth, water, fire, and wind, they are just metaphors. They didn't believe there was little pieces of dirt in you, or little pieces of fire in you, or something like that. They described basic types of energy that would be perfectly acceptable to the scientists. And it's people that haven't studied Abhidharma, that explain it wrong, and it sounds weird, and stuff like that. It's certain characteristics of physical matter that you can accept, any Westerner can accept easily. Those are the four elements. So what he says, he uses the same process of elimination. He says, do you mean to say that all four elements have to act together? Or is any one of the elements sufficient? Which would imply that if one of the elements were, if any of the atoms were not present, then the mind wouldn't occur. You know, if one of the atoms happened to be missing, would mind never occur? Or are you saying that any one of the atoms could have created mind? Could have flopped over into mind? Are you saying that all those atoms have to be present together? In which case, if one of them happens to be missing, there's no mind? Or are you saying any one of them can turn into mind, and the others are just helping? And neither one is correct. It's the same argument. If they all have to be present for the mind to start in your mommy's coming, in the first moment of your awareness, then the minute one of them weren't there, your mind should go away. And that's not what happened. Or if it's any one of them turns into mind, then how does the mind resemble that one? You know, is the mind hot if it comes to an element of fire, or is the mind more ferric if it comes from iron atoms? You know, there's no similarity between the iron atom and the mind. If the iron atom flopped into the mind should resemble iron in some way, in the way that a tree resembles an acorn. There has to be some similarity, and there isn't.
Are they considered secondary factors?
Is it thought that the mind, that the changes in the physical constituents affect the mind? Yes. Can they be a factor? Yes. Are they near Lan Ki Yu? No. And we get hung up on the secondary factors. Western people get hung up on the chemicals that happen to be present when mind starts. And they mistake that for the near Lan Ki Yu of the mind. But mind in no way resembles matter. There's no similarity at all. Mind is invisible, crystal clear, and aware. And physical matter is the opposite. There's no similarity. It's to a Buddhist philosopher, it's a laughing. What's he saying? It would be a joke to laugh about for someone to come and say, you know, all these chemicals in your body could turn into this crystal clear, ineffable, invisible, unaffectable, knowing thing called mind. They just think it's silly. Who would ever imagine that? You know, the mind is, you could blow up an atom bomb next to a mind and it doesn't move a half an inch. Mind is different. Mind is not affected by matter. You can't push your mind to the left or the right. You can't split your mind up. You can't say that the left side of the mind is different from the right side of the mind. You can't distinguish its boundaries. The mind can stretch to Kansas right now, the moment you think of Kansas. The mind, the stuff of mind is totally different from matter. And it's just some kind of funny thing that we grew up with that we think any other way. The mind is invisible. The mind is ineffable. The mind somehow hangs around the body, but it's in no way restricted by the body. The mind can go anywhere right now.
Is it appropriate to be kind of taking it to that almost metaphorical level of comparing the physical nature of the body to the physical nature of the mind, to say that if it's not physically resembling it, it doesn't come from that? I mean, is that just not an irrelevant?
It's just the nature of a neural entity. There should be some similarity.
I mean, it should look the same.
Must be some similarity.
In appearance.
Same characteristics. Now, the characteristics have to be physical characteristics? No. But in this case, yes, since you're talking about matter.
Michael, I'm really confused. What is the definition of mind? Because when you say
that... Definition of mind is very simple. Salashingrita. Clear and knowing. Clear and aware.
So this is like sort of Buddha mind from not our ordinary consciousness?
No, absolutely talking about your ordinary consciousness. It only has two qualities. It's clear, it's ineffable, and it's aware.
But like, a lot of us don't feel particularly clear or aware right now.
Clear in the sense, you see, that the word clear in Buddhism even is very difficult. People, when they try to translate it, the word clear in the definition of mind is very difficult. Does it mean that you can't see it? Or does it mean that it's always clear of bad thoughts or clear of confusion? Obviously, it can't be the second one. Obviously, your mind is often confused or unclear. So I should say it refers more to its quality of being ineffable. Clear here means can't see it, can't touch it, can't taste it, can't move it, can't cut it, can't squish it, can't make it bigger. It's just not like that. It's different stuff. It's a totally different stuff. It doesn't resemble physical stuff at all. It's a different material. And that's a very important distinction. In Buddhism, you have to become aware that the mind resides somewhere in the vicinity of the body, right? Somehow related to the body. And we'll talk more about that. But it's different. A Buddhist philosopher at a certain point in his training would say, how could you possibly think that mind could come from anything physical? They're completely different. You can't shoot the mind, you can't squish the mind, you can't make a hole in the mind, you can't... Mind is different thing. Mind is different, totally different stuff. Where's your mind?
See, I'm really confused because there's a mundane definition of the brain. I mean, you can just go to somebody's brain.
Brain is some gray color and round shape.
Right, and if you squish that, their mind won't work.
You sure?
Well, maybe their next
slide. I'm not asking that facetious question. You're assuming the mind.
Well, there are people that, let's say, are in a car accident and their mind never works the same way afterwards. So
you don't know that.
Nobody says their brain dead, mind dead, they say their brain dead.
Right, and they still go into a coma. I mean, we don't really know what they're thinking about, but it appears to us.
It appears, and the Charvakas had the same argument. They said, it seems to be that if the body undergoes a certain level of shock, that the mind stops. And until that level of shock is made to the body, the mind continues. And if you beat the brain, or if you hit the head at a certain kind level of force, it appears that the mind stops. And that's all you can say. You don't know that the mind stops.
No, but that person will have a very hard time functioning in this incarnation.
Oh, no. Yeah, obviously there's some relation between... That's again. some conditions for the function of the mind have been altered. The mind, is the mind made less mind? No. And we're going to talk about it. And I'll give you a foretaste, okay? Dharmakirti is going to try to argue that not only does the mind not rely on the brain relies on the mind. That's going to be his argument. And I'll get into it next week. But you've reached mentally a very important point, because he must bring it up by the next class. He's going to bring it up. Does the mind rest on the body, or perhaps the body rests on the mind? And that's, we'll do that next week.
Where does sensory consciousness fit in relation to the mind?
It's the mind is composed of six consciousnesses acting together. Five sense consciousnesses and one mental consciousness.
But you said that the mind is something that couldn't be influenced or altered, and when
its nature is not. No. But we had said before, it's like a mirror. You know, if you present, if you put a blue wall in front of the eyes, the mind takes on some kind of blueness, and we accept that. It takes on some kind of, like a glass, or like when you take water and when you paint the bottom of a swimming pool blue, and then you pour water into the swimming pool, the water takes on some kind of blue appearance. It's not blue, but it takes on some kind of blue tint. It's not that the water got blue. It's the blueness is being reflected in the water. And then they say the mind is the same.
So if you damage one of the sensory powers, the mind doesn't change.
No.
The content changes. The
content changes. Mm-hmm. You can't have a blue color anymore. But
so
actually you can.
So sensory consciousness in itself is what? In other words,
it's a clear and aware about that. Okay, we got it. She has to be in there. But we'll talk about it. You have to study first chapter of Abhidhamma. It's a long, long story. The first chapter of the Abhidhamma presents this, and it's almost a quarter of the whole book. It has eight chapters, but the first chapter is so important that it's about a quarter of the whole book. And it explains the six sense, the six consciousnesses. And it's accepted by all the other schools, pretty much. We got one more place to go. He says, now, the last choice is mine. The last choice for what? Good, Nirlin Kijyu. What's flopped over into the first moment of consciousness? What's right behind the door that pushed this consciousness through the door at the moment of birth, at the moment of conception? What was behind that unknown? You know, what shoved our mind into the first moment of this life? He says, now you have no... If you accept all of my arguments, which you don't, which you probably shouldn't, yeah. I mean, I think we've all had some trouble with some of them. I'm presenting, you know, KWJ's arguments, but I think they need to be cooked, you know. But if you, let's say, you accept all those arguments, then the only place left to go by the process of elimination is that it had to have been mine. That flopped over into mind. It became mind. Now, K2J says, was it your mind or someone else's mind? Not a silly question. I mean, we generally, I think, believe that somehow our life... You know, I've been thinking about it because I have to teach it. But I think somehow you think that life has been transmitted to those cells from the parents. That somehow... there's this stuff you call life, and at a certain point in the child's development, it gets transferred to that jelly, you know. And at a certain point in the child's development, it gets transferred to that jelly, you know. And it comes from the parents, you know. I mean, I think you really, if you're a scientist, you're probably over here, I think. It's chemicals. Certain chemicals under certain conditions become mine. And if you're, you know, a mommy, you know, all the living parts of my body have become life. You know, or me and my husband's body have become life. And or maybe you think, you know, somehow the father and the mother's mind have flowed into the to the little spot of jello.
It's them,
you know,
thinking that the things that they've done in their life are going to determine what's in their child's mind stream.
Well, no, but that the child of the mind came from the minds of the father and mother. I mean, KMJ says, that's your, I'll give you two last choices. This is where he wants to go, right? This is his, the whole object of the whole thing tonight. This is where he wants to prove that it came from your own mind of the past. But he's allowing you, okay, maybe it was your mommy and your daddy. Now, how does he argue against that? He says, sometimes the father is a master carpenter and but the kid can't do anything with his hands. Sometimes the father is an idiot and the kid is brilliant. So he says, it can't be. And it sounds simple and it sounds childlike. And some of the Sarva Dharmakirti's arguments are going to sound very childlike. But I warn you, maybe they are true. And maybe they're very deep. And maybe they're right. So, you know, and you can't go to office and give these arguments to everybody there. But if you really think about them, you might conclude that you did live before.
There seems to be a lot of these separate families. Very often in these discussions, the distinction is made between mind as something that animates the brain, the body, everything the body is composed of, and is in some sense the spirit, let's say, it's being called that also,
yeah,
the West, that animates this,
yeah,
this body, that is separate from genes from which, you know, by means of which you may inherit certain physical characteristics, certain talents, certain whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that there isn't necessarily a contradiction between acknowledging that there is something besides the body, and the mind and the body are not equivalent, or, you know, are they integral parts of one another?
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I sat with psychiatrists on the last flight. So we talked a lot about this. It's part of his work. And he said ultimately they don't really understand. You know, they can't really affect certain genes and the child is more intelligent or something. Right now they can't. But anyway.
So what's the argument then?
So the argument, he's saying that, that's his final argument, okay? And that's 9 o'clock too. he's saying, you know, it's not true that the child is more or less intelligent. According, in other words, the condition of the child's mind doesn't necessarily have any similarity to the condition of the parents. And one of the rules of a Nyingma view is that it should have some similarity. An acorn has to somehow have oakness in it, or else it would make a lemon, it might as well make a lemon tree, but it doesn't, does it? There's some similarity. So he eliminates that one. Therefore, you came from your previous life.
How does he support that the mind is retained intact? And how is that explained to travel from last?
We'll talk about it. That'll be next week. We'll get to Dharmakirti's own argument. But
so it has to be of the moment before the first awareness.
It has to have been a previous state of mind of your own. And the last thing I'll say is, once you prove that last instance, that once you prove the existence of a single moment of mind preceding the first moment of mind in your mommy's womb, then your lives are beginningless and your lives are endless. Period. Your mind is beginningless and your mind is endless. It's a necessary conclusion. Once I can prove a single instant of your own consciousness prior to your first consciousness in this mommy's womb, it might as well be beginning. In fact, it has to be beginning.
I keep coming back and somehow comes out of your head.
Okay, last question. Okay, I know something more about
it.
Go ahead.
This doesn't have to be a class.
Say.
You know, I can understand that emptiness is a concept, so it's generated, it's being generated, shall we say.
Whoa, what?
Well, I mean, the emptiness of something is our labeling, our naming it.
No, the emptiness is negative, so how would you say it negatively?
The lack of naming it.
The lack of not naming it.
Right. But, so that doesn't, I don't have a problem with that as a permanent thing. But, space, I think I asked this before, when we were talking about creating.
How is space unchanging?
What's the explanation for the existence of space, I guess?
Where did it come from?
Yeah.
It's,
I mean, you say that it's always being.
No, it's defined as an absence of something.
Okay, so it's just, it's, in a sense, it's like...
It's totally gotsam, it's a definition of space. It's a simple absence of anything concrete.
Then when you put the pen in that space, you said the space isn't changed, and yet there's a concrete object in the space.
Yeah.
So how
if it weren't absent of any concrete object, the pen couldn't get in there.
Yeah, but so when the pen's there, then it's no longer space, is your point. In which case,
and the answer to that by Bruce Walter is that since the pen is there, it's absent.
The space is absent.
No, the concrete is absent. Because if it were already occupied, you couldn't put the pen in there.
Right. So the fact that it is occupied and not space is a kind of...
If it weren't space, the pen couldn't stay there.
Right. But I'm saying, the fact that it becomes occupied...
If the space went away, when the pen occupied, the pen couldn't stay there, because there wouldn't be any space for the occupied.
But by definition...
So when a female that is pregnant is being taught to have these good, pure thoughts, it's to have indirect effect upon their child's mind.
Yeah, right. Okay. The mind doesn't come from that. Doesn't turn into them. Those thoughts don't turn into them.
But they affect the environment?
Absolutely.
Do you see what I mean? If you said the definition of space is the absence of something, then it's no longer absence, so then by definition is no longer space.
Simple absence of concreteness.
Did you have the recorder on for that? Listen to that over again. So, the other space is not supposed to have concrete. This is the thing that's supposed to have.
Well, then there's a debate about that. You sure I don't know.
Oh, no. This is big news.
Even that.
So the Buddha's body,
period.
Sashi Bhagavad Gita Shemeta Sham Viravinshi Nyande Yampadi
This is the end of Class 7.